pack your things.
Where are we going?
Somewhere we belong.
If you are listening to the show and wish to join us in the chat room, visit powtalk.com. Go to the social issues, select other, and enter the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
The paranormal.
Ghosts.
Spirits.
Demons.
Reincarnation.
Past lives.
The afterlife.
Divination.
Exorcisms.
Witchcraft.
The unseen.
He's psychic medium Chris George.
And he's Victor the Voice Furman.
We are Second Sight Radio. Join us live
every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time
on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Is reality. The connection is you. Check out Catherine Buckaloo on Truth Connections Radio, Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on 107.7 FM, the Paranormal Radio Network.
Cemetery with your hosts Chip and Nicole every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, mindcemetery.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we host News on the Flip Side. Come join us every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Central for our three-hour program. We have opinions on everything, and we're not afraid to share them. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can find it here with News on the Flip Side. Remember, don't be politically correct. Just be correct. Join us.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
I was asked to put new SpeedStick gear to the test. A very extreme sweat test. I call it Canyon Swing. New SpeedStick gear has dry core technology, so it absorbs better, giving me 48 hours of sweat protection. Yep, still dry. New SpeedStick gear, engineered for advanced performance.
Another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and we have our usual announcements to make before we get started tonight. Now, for all of you Facebookers out there, we do have a Facebook group specifically used for this radio program, and it provides an easy way for everyone to make comments or even ask questions about the program in general. Now, I do not monitor the page during the program, so please don't try to ask a question during the show there because it won't make the air. Like always for tonight's program, I would love to have the audience's input with questions and comments. So you can email them to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. You can also email me with questions from or about previous guests, and I'll try and get those answered for you as well. And here in a few minutes, I'll even bring up Twitter. So if you want to send me a question via Twitter, just stick at gscott, all lowercase, one word, in the comment, and it will pop up in my little window there, and I'll see what you're wanting to know about. I also have an author page on Facebook, and I would love to have everyone visit my author page there. Give me a like for support and find out what is going on. So you can check it out and help a starving author. okay, this program, because the more books you buy, the more money I may have to spend on things that do with the program, ranging from equipment to the monthly regular expenses. Now, tonight's program is sort of a mishmash. We've had some audio difficulties, and that's here at my end, not at the station. My fill-in guest was going to be Gregory Miller, and he's sitting in the other room anxiously working on a computer that just doesn't want to behave. So hopefully he will be joining us later in the program. In the meantime, you've got me talking to you about everything from current events to spring itself. Now today we took a drive in our vehicle and went out to the little lake nearby. Even though the weather was less than cooperative, it was cold and windy here in southern Mississippi today. Not exactly sort of an outdoorsy kind of day at the lake. Lots of white caps, gray skies, you know, just kind of gloomy. We saw a couple of loons, and that was about the extent of it. And, you know, drove around, and we stopped by a local nursery. Now, you know, in this day and age of fast and furious and nationwide corporations, you know, we're used to seeing the garden center in Corporation X's store, and, you know, seeing another one in Corporation Y's store. It was kind of nice to go into a place with a local proprietor who knows local plants, and I could ask questions about some of the old plants that I've got growing around the house here and get possible answers about what they are, what they, you know, why they may have been planted here, as well as even in some cases how to kill them. Now, we have the old, ugly crepe myrtles, and they've been pollarded. And for people who are not familiar with the term pollarding, that's where the branches are amputated, cut real short. And over time, those pollarded branches will create a knot. Some species of trees do it real quickly. Others, it takes a little longer before they get the knot. These are very old crepe myrtles, so they're kind of gnarly and silvery and actually pretty spooky because they're naked, silvery things 6-8 months of the year. And, you know, they're real old. They need taken out and replaced. You know, when I stand out in the street and I look at, we've had it for going on 2 years. It'll be 2 years this August. You know, renovations happen fairly slowly, especially when you're interrupted with things like Greg having a heart attack and the other traumas that occur with a family over a period of a couple of years. So, you know, all these things kind of slow us down with getting things done. And so I look up at the place, and it's got its old siding, and, you know, the overgrown landscaping, because we haven't done a whole lot with that yet. And these 27 dead-looking trees marching in a triple row across the front of the house. And I look at these, and I think, oh, my goodness, I know it. The Addams family lives here. It's no wonder no neighborhood kids bother us. We don't get the door-to-door solicitors. Nobody gives us religious tracts. I mean, nobody comes to our door. I mean, it's spooky-looking. You know, if we let the grass get a little long, it's even more profound. I'm just glad we don't have, you know, like giant spider webs, because there are some giant spiders in the South. Spider quite impressed me when I first moved to the South, as its web stretched across the entire branch of the bayou. So it's like, you know, 15 feet wide, this spider web. And I'm looking at it, and the silk is so coarse. I'm thinking, that's not to catch insects. I'm sure that thing catches birds, you know, hummingbirds, small finches, you know, that kind of bird. It's huge. And then this, because I was on a swamp tour when I saw this spider the first time. I've seen it lots of times since. But he's telling us that they can jump. I'm like, this boat's not long enough, okay, because I'm really not crazy about spiders. In my opinion, spiders are trying to take over the world. And when my house is invaded by these evil alien spiders, I have a basic method of attack. You start off with something toxic to spray. Now, of course, insecticide is your obvious first choice. But if that's not available, hairspray, foaming bathroom cleaners, those work too. Then when you sprayed this evil alien with enough things that it's having convulsions, you then go get the lethal weapon, an 8-foot long tube of four. Now you can smash it. Then, of course, you now have a room contaminated with evil alien bug guts. So you don't go in there for, like, weeks, months, forever, until somebody else comes and removes the evil alien bug guts. Yeah, obviously my husband gets called upon frequently for spider duty. I'm not crazy about him. Let's see about bringing up, I promised I was going to bring up Twitter here, so we're going to see about doing just that. And like I said before, if you have never used Twitter, or if you're a regular user, in either case, you can find me and follow me. That's just GiaScott, GiaScott, and you just put that little at symbol in front, and bingo, you will find me. And if you have a question or comment, you can send that to me right through Twitter. And moving right along, it looks like we're going to be able to have Gregory join us now. And that will give you a little break from me telling you my spider stories. The spiders, you know, I really don't like them. I'm not crazy about mosquitoes either, obviously. They're itchy little bites. Can be somewhat annoying. But spring is on us, and I have cabbage and Brussels sprouts and broccoli planted in my little raised beds. I've got a larger plot that's been rototilled up, courtesy of my son-in-law. And Gregory, are you here?
I'm lurking around.
You're looking around, huh? Okay, well,
You're what? Yeah, after not taking the hammer, which literally, folks, if you had a video camera, you'd see it. Seriously, you do have a hammer sitting next to the computer. The hammer was not used as the primary interface, so I've been able to join you live. And, you know, we did have some fun. I heard a little bit, folks, I'm actually in the studio area, so you might actually also hear my little dog that's outside being good right now. Well,
yeah,
we had some fun, but it was a little bit brisk.
Today was a nice day, but it, you know, talking about this little local nursery, you know, folks, frequent your little local businesses like that, the mom and pop businesses. Second generation is now working in the nursery we went to. Their prices are great. Actually, we did stop by Corporation X's Garden Center right after we left the little nursery. And, you know, plants that were $2.50 at the local nursery were $3.50 or higher at Corporation Y's, version, and didn't have the same kind of variety, didn't have the same offerings at all, and you certainly didn't have the helpful information that I obtained from the little local place.
It'd be nice if you could remember what the name of the bush was. I know it started with an A.
Well, you remember more than me. I will have to look it up. You know, some things I remember, but yeah, we have this little bush that grows everywhere, and it was used as a foundation plant around our house in some places. It was used along our fence line, and it volunteers any place that it can get a start. And I was inquiring as to what it was and how to get rid of it. And as I suspected, it's not going to be easy. The crepe myrtles are even worse, though. Yeah, here we have to... in order to get rid of the crepe myrtle, if we don't have a tractor to jerk them out with, and we don't, and the location isn't conducive to, even if we went and bought a tractor for the job, jerking them out is just not an option. So the only way to get rid of them is to cut them off down at the ground level and drill a hole down into the remnant of the stump and fill it with Roundup.
You know, for folks that are are listening across the country that really have no idea what a crepe myrtle plant is, it doesn't have anything to do with crepe paper. And believe me, it's a lot tougher than that. And these, Gianna's is a technical term for what's happened with them, but I will just say that the people trained these bushes, so they look like twisted, gnarled little trees. And the problem with them is that people like to grow them. They're cute. It's something that they want, and then they grow it to make it look the way that they want it. So then they end up with a little custom myrtle bush in front of the house. And if you don't like the way that it has been trained to grow, you're not necessarily going to come along to Greg's house, tie a chain around it, pull it up by the root ball, and drag that off on the back of a pickup truck and replant it at your house. And I wish somebody would do that, but the way that myrtles are always done, people are putting them in for custom reasons, and they let them grow years and years and years, and nobody seems to want the adult ones, even though they are transplantable.
Well, part of it, and this is what Greg isn't understanding, plants have varieties, and as time goes on, they're bred to be bigger, badder, better. Crepe myrtles 60 years ago came in one color. They were virtually identical to the wild version, and simply by training them, as he put it, which is pruning off the suckers so that they grow as a single tree, and in this case they were also pollarded, and these old crepe myrtles don't bloom as long or as profusely as the more modern varieties do. They were also only available in, as I put it, Pepto-Bismol pink, which is about the least appealing color I can imagine. I happen to despise wintergreen. It acts as a stomach irritant in my case, and even works even faster than Ipecac. So, you know, anything that reminds me of wintergreen just isn't going to do a lot for me. And that color reminds me of wintergreen. Anyhow, 27 of them is 27 too many as far as I'm concerned. I would much rather have something more appealing like blueberries, which I love, or, you know, something, you know, that just bloom more often. These were, you know, some of the more interesting colors. They have double crepe myrtle. They have, it's available in everything from white to purple. Various colors of pink that are much more appealing, and so forth and so on. Anyhow, these crepe myrtles are facing murder. As soon as they start to leaf out, probably another 6 weeks or so, they're going to meet their end via a chainsaw, and I think it's properly called glyphosate.
Roundup.
Otherwise known as Roundup.
Well, the key thing to remember with that is, as a lady at the nursery was apt to remind you, Gia, that people have this misconception with the Roundup, too, that it only kills what it touches in the vein of plant matter. It'll go into the freshly cut crepe myrtle and then into its root system. It will not go beyond the root system of the plant and then affect the grass or the other trees or shrubs around it, unless you were using a sprayer and you tried spraying the outside of the plant, and then it washed off with the water, you know, from your sprinkler or your garden hose or the rain, and then you're causing the Roundup to spread and kill other things. So the way that you're talking about using it does also sound a little abnormal, but if you think about it, what you're doing is you're cutting off, and when the plant is trying to take back in the nutrient that was at the top of the plant after it's been chainsawed, that's why it's receptive to taking in the poison, and then it's going to just basically kill it down. And then you get the fun of having to take it out by the root structure, which is, you know, we're just talking about amputating the plants and making them into 27 little hard, nasty stumps. We're not talking about all of the fun that I'm going to have with a pickaxe and a shovel.
Well, actually, you know, I figured, you know, out of all the things that termites do for us, you know, they can at least return the favor by eating those stumps. Considering the amount of termite damage that is in the old trunks and stuff that these crepe myrtles, some of them are surrounded these stumps, the termites have been at those stumps, those dead portions already. I'm hoping that they just, you know, do their thing and eat the stump. At least they'll be
Stay
low
away
enough.
From the house.
Well, yeah. But at least they will be down where I don't have to look at these horrible Addams Family trees anymore. You know, excuse me. I call them trees.
Ouch.
They're only about 12 foot tall, maybe 15 feet in some cases. So they're not real big. They don't cast a lot of shade. In fact, the first summer we were here, that fall we put in two blueberries and two kiwis. And then last spring we put in another blueberry. And those are all, you know, growing in amongst these crepe myrtles, which really, like I said, they really don't offer much in terms of shade even.
Well, folks, one of the things that gets confusing about it, just from my point of view, is that I don't know what's supposed to be there, what's not supposed to be there, what's going to come out, and really, we're going to have to go through and take a camera and go through and kind of section the yard and everything off, and then you're going to have it where you have to make notes and almost as if I'm doing an archaeological expedition in my own yard to make sure I'm not killing the wrong thing, because I'm sure you don't want to listen to Gia coming back on the Dawn of Shades with one of our gardening guests talking about, I can't believe Greg killed the blueberry bush or the kiwi plant or, you know, the holly or something else because I was in the wrong section, you know, committing suicide on the wrong thing.
Yeah, and I do have murderous designs on, we have a tree that's a member of an invasive species, the Chinese tallow tree, otherwise known as popcorn tree. It doesn't even make good firewood because...
It doesn't make good popcorn either, folks.
No, I gather you can use it if you're desperate to make candles or something. We're not desperate for candles, and if it smells nearly as bad as wood does when it's burning, I would hate to have to burn a candle made out of that stuff. It smells like something that has been soaked, not just merely sprayed, but soaked in male cat urine. It really, really stinks.
She's not exaggerating. I've burned it, and also there's a couple of the invasive species, too, that when you burn them, they can cause a toxic reaction. If it gets into the tear ducts in your eyes, it could cause temporary blindness. I mean, there's some stuff that just gets really nasty, and it's one of the differences between living in the South and living in the Northeast or living in the Northwest or living in the Southwest is you have all these different plant species, and really they don't react the same. If you have a forest fire in Oregon, it's going to be completely different than if you have the equivalent of a forest fire on the southern coast, the Gulf Coast, between Florida and Texas. You're going to have things burning in there that you aren't going to want to be near because they literally can either burn you up really fast because of the plant and its flammability, or they're going to kill you because what they put off when they do burn is toxic.
Yeah, you know, I can remember living in Arizona and during forest fires, you knew as soon as the duff started burning, because it creates a particularly acrid smoke that really stings your eyes and makes them water and, like, burns your nose and throat as you're trying to breathe. And that was even from 25, 30 miles away, because I didn't live in the forest. So when it would be burning on the Mogollon Rim someplace, I'm way up on the plateau, like I said, 25 miles or further in some cases away from the fire. And yet the smoke would be thick enough that when I had horses, I had one horse that just absolutely went nuts if she could smell smoke. She was just a nervous basket case. And, you know, when the duff would be burning, that smoke even that far away would just really sting. You know, and this past weekend I was down south, okay? When you're only 100 miles away, down south can, you know, is someplace in that 100 miles. But I was down south visiting relatives, and there was a couple of fires over the weekend in a couple of different locations. I don't know what burned, whether it was a house or it was a wildfire. We do have wildfire warnings right now because it's unusually dry. We haven't had rain in like 3 or 4 days now. And somebody who spent most of her life in the South, I find that, or in the West, I find that hilarious that it's now, you know, high fire risk and considered practically a drought. But now we haven't had rain in days. And these fires, some of them were dropping ashes, which were really thin flakes of charred wood all around the house, covering, you know, vehicles and trampoline and that kind of stuff, with these flakes of charred wood. And, you know, the sun would be brilliant red shining through that smoke, because the smoke would be really, really thick. And, you know, I know that in a lot of areas, spring is when they do the prescribed burns. A lot of people may think that's horrible, but over time they've discovered that all fires are bad fires was wrong. And what it created was situations that were perfect for devastating fires. And a forest fire shouldn't be devastating to a forest. It should be a case of renewal. It shouldn't burn millions of acres. It should just burn a small amount, and so forth and so on. And so the prescribed burns burn off the excessive amounts of duff. They kill some of the vegetation. They allow other vegetation to disperse their seeds. Many plants need fire in order to finish the process of ripening their seeds and dispersing them. It clears off stuff so that new things can start to grow. And it's part of the whole natural process that should be occurring in a forest. Here in the South, we have a lot of planted woods dating from when there were huge plantations for the paper products. And, you know, it tends to be a monoculture. And, you know, we've had other programs about permaculture and monocultures and the differences. But anytime you have a monoculture, you have a situation where disease can become devastating. And so they do some prescribed burning here as well. We also have some national forests not far from us. And I know they do some prescribed burns in there. So a lot of it is done this time of year, because typically the spring is moist. It's a good time to do it. Burn off the old and the new naturally grows. And so pay attention. You know, if you come up on smoke when you're driving down the highway, or you hear that an area's got a prescribed burn, stay away. You don't need to be getting in everybody's way when they're doing it.
Yeah, one thing also, as a motorist, if you don't have a sign on the side of the road or police that are telling you that there's a fire, but it's obvious that smoke's coming up, one of the first things you should do, if you don't have daytime running lamps on your vehicle, is flip your lights on and leave them on until you get out of the smoke, because even if you're on a divided interstate, for somebody to be able to see you coming up behind them is one of the, you know, the most important things. Because if you get too close to them, it could be too late if they stop directly in front of you. But if they can't see you coming, they're likely to cut you off and then cause a problem, and you don't want that. And driving in smoke is just as bad, as, if not worse, than driving in rain. And there are a lot of people that, for whatever reason, don't flip their headlamps on when it's raining either.
Or during fog. You know, smoke is very similar to fog, I find. It can be, you drop your visibility down to, you know, 10, 20 feet in some cases. And it can do it unexpectedly. You know, they may be doing this burn. There may have been no issues with smoke building up along a nearby highway. All of a sudden the wind changes and now, or the temperatures change, and now this smoke is going right over the highway, or it's pooling in a low spot on the highway, and so forth and so on. So, you know, if you do come up in smoke on the highway, don't stop in the middle of the highway. Do turn on your lights and do pay attention. You know, you don't want to become a statistic.
Yeah, you want to kind of make it home. You know, and that's just sort of what we were out having a little fun with, folks. A lot of times you worry about things on the road. Statistically speaking, of course, you are most likely to have an accident, even a fatal accident, within about a mile to a mile and a half of your home, simply because you become preoccupied with what you're either going to do once you get home, or you are preoccupied with what you are needing to do as you're leaving. So we sort of suggest, a moment or two of just clearing everything out of your head before you just jump in, start the ignition, hit reverse, go out the driveway. You know, that's when bad things can happen. I know it sounds a little screwy, but, a minute or so of just, not thinking too much about the fact that you need to get back to the red box of Walmart to drop off that movie before you a larger insurance claim or running over the neighbor's cat or who knows. And that's usually how that stuff happens.
Yeah, yeah. And, when we all go driving, especially with our significant others, there's all these jokes about women drivers and women backseat drivers. Now, today I was doing the driving. And Gregory, of course, was sitting in the passenger seat. Folks, women may have the reputation of being the backseat driver. You should have. The light is red. There's a garbage can. There's a car. You need to slow down. You need to speed up. You're going to turn here. They're right there. When you back out, you need to go to your right. You would have thought that I had never driven before. Ever, ever, ever. Greg was an impossible backseat driver. I told him next time I'm going to put him in the backseat wearing a special pair of glasses that I've spray painted just for driving, or when I'm driving, rather. Yeah, give him a movie or something.
She wants to make a bigger deal out of it than it actually is. Folks, I guess, she'd much rather have Ray Charles than the passenger seat.
Well, I think part of the reason that I razz him so much about being such a bad backseat driver today is, of course, if I say anything as we're going along, the light's green, the light's red, watch out for that guy, whatever, speed limit reminders, whatever it is I say, I'm nagging. But if he's sitting over there doing it 10 times more frequently than I ever do, it's not nagging. He's simply commenting on the driving conditions.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
so, I keep telling him what's good for the goose is good for the gander. But, anybody that listens to us sometimes. Go ahead, Greg.
I'm practicing pointing out the explicitly.
He's practicing pointing out the obvious is really what he's doing. Because if I didn't see that large black garbage can laying on the road in front of me, I shouldn't have been driving to begin with. I mean, if nothing else, he could have looked on it as a test. Is she really blind? Yeah. Because we're talking large.
I was more
black.
Concerned about whether or not you saw the Toyota going around the garbage can and almost up onto the sidewalk, it was the actual trash can itself. But, folks, that's what kind of a windy day that we did have here in the mid-southeastern Mississippi area. The trash barrels were being blown out into the road and coming in obstruction. And even at the nursery where we were visiting, they were having problems with some of the plants being toppled over because being alongside of the state route, they have a considerable more of a dust kick up and a wind from the trucks going by than you would really expect a place to have. But on a day when you have plus 30 mile an hour winds, and really that's what we were coping with, it can become sort of a problem. And so I think that's why some of the things were closed up a little, and that's why we were seeing the trash cans doing the cha-cha around the front of Walmart.
Yeah, when we talk about winds, 30 miles an hour here, and there's all kinds of high wind warnings, high profile vehicle warnings. People are battening down the hatches, and they're complaining a lot about the wind too. And I think back to when I lived in northern Arizona, this spring season was the time when we always got these horrible winds. It was usually, you could just about lay money that Good Friday, whenever Good Friday was, the interstate, I-40, was going to be closed because of high wind conditions, actually blowing over semi-trucks going down the road. Gusts were recorded at, 280 miles an hour and faster. I've been outside, with 200 mile an hour gusts and higher winds. When wind is like that, it can knock you over. You have to be hanging on to something to give you additional stability. Yeah, even below 100 miles an hour, it's going to blow your eyes shut. It's going to blow your nostrils shut on the side where the wind is hitting you. It'll make you stagger and lose your balance. It may not necessarily blow you on over, but you can stagger and lose your balance. I've known people that have had vehicles that were parked, shut off, in park, and were literally blown over the edges of a cliff because, they were up on, there was a drop off at the edge of the parking lot or something. And these vehicles were literally blown over. Bricks were blown off of buildings. And this was normal. We used to make jokes that we used to have the Rocky Mountains, but they blew to Colorado because these winds were just impossible. And it would go on for about a week. It was when the Gulf Stream would dip at way south into northern Arizona, and it would bring all these really awful winds. You didn't have sandstorms or dirt storms during this. You had gravel and rock storms. I've literally seen walnut-sized rocks being blown in the wind. It's miserable. You cannot function when the wind is blowing like that. Everybody just kind of has to batten down the hatches and not be outside because you really cannot function. I would, go out long enough to get to and from the vehicle because obviously I still had to go to work and do all the other things. When I had horses and stuff like that, they still had to be fed. But everybody just really kind of hunkers down. The same way at those 200-mile-an-hour gusts as we are at the 30-mile-an-hour gust here. So wind is kind of relative to where you live. 70 and 80-mile-an-hour winds were, pretty common. We got them a lot with gusts that high. But, the well over 100 and pushing 200, we usually only got in the spring, thank goodness, because I don't think we could have took it if it was more often than that. That's like hurricane-forced winds. The difference was we didn't have any water with it. We just had rocks and sand and dirt. So wind is kind of relative to where you live and to what you're used to, I guess, too. When I was at the beach on the Gulf Coast on Friday, and we probably had a brisk 20-mile-an-hour wind the entire time we were there. It was actually fairly nice. It was a nice warm day. The wind was coming in off the water. We actually played in the water a little bit, which was kind of a surprise. Kind of fun. We had my granddaughter, and we had a good time playing around and playing in the sand, and really enjoyed it. And then, today it was jackets. We have a freeze warning for tonight. That's the spring weather here in the South.
Well, I don't. I think, to be honest, that people who are still digging through things in the Northeast, they kind of have a different perspective of it. I happen to know that there are people who are having a whiteout blizzard this afternoon while I was talking to them on the phone. I mean, that's just 1,000 miles north of us. And for people who have suffered through this, probably like a fourth or now a third most heinous winter, and possibly some of them within their lifetime, the worst winter that they've seen, they have my sincere condolences.
So I can remember.
I
remember storms when I was a kid. Snow drifts as high as a 2.5-story house. Snow drifts that covered roads 15, 20 feet deep. There's a reason why I don't live in snow country anymore. I'm not sure I could cope with that kind of snow. So the people that are enduring it in first person, you have my heartfelt sympathies. I know what snow sounds like when it gets to 0 degrees, that very familiar squeak that you get. I know how it feels to have to cover your face because it's so cold that you cannot breathe the air without pre-warming it through your scarf. That's tough climate. And, yeah, I'm really glad that we're not enduring it. And it's the end of March. It is also our anniversary show here on the Dawn of Shades. We started the last Tuesday of March, you know, and I'm not even sure how many years it's actually been. Yeah, it's been a while. I know that. I think we just finished our seventh year, but I could be wrong.
How about the eighth year?
We finished the eighth year?
We have a guest that actually has maybe coming on with us the second hour, who actually was on with us in 2008.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so...
Time flies. Time flies when you have fun. I'm sure Joe, back in the studio, probably also forgotten how long we've really been on the air. Some days, and then other days we'll have perfect recall.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then when we talk with guests and, you know, people that we've had on before, some people that are listening in the audience actually go back 14 or 15 years of, you know, putting up listening to either one of us on the internet for this long. It just, you know, it's amazing. And for you to have done the show without having lost your sanity, to say nothing of our executive producer and all of our friends who put all of these programs together on a weekly basis. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, it is something to hear your spouse say something about how I've not lost my sanity. You know, we're going to have to talk about this great American adventure that I still want to do, since I have not lost my sanity on a couple of the other projects I've got on my mind. Yeah.
You know, but I would like to take a moment, though, and say that, you know, over the course of the last year or two, you know, we've lost some people in the arena of, the, you know, the field of study and cooperation and interest that we all shared with the UFO Paranormal Radio Network that's now the United Public Radio Network. And the last couple of weeks we lost Dr. Roger Lear. You know, it's getting down to the point that we're not going to say we're having a guessing game as to who's next. It's just, it's important for, you know, everybody in the area of studies of the extraterrestrial and UFO phenomenon to get some more of the information out there before the people who have seen things end up at such advanced age that you can't qualify their testimony and everything as dementia.
Dementia.
Rest in peace, Dr. Lear.
Well, you know, too, it's not just been the UFO and alien phenomena arena that's lost a number of people. You know, I actually began feeling as though I was some kind of a jinx for a while because I had, in a period of just a couple of months, a number of guests died before they appeared. And other guests were having terrible things happen to family members.
We're going to say we're not a jinx, everybody. And, you know, we miss Roger Lear. We're going to miss Lloyd Pye. We're going to miss Philip Coppens. But it's time, Gia, for us to take our break on the United Public Radio Network with Dawn of Shades.
Yep, I see that. So, folks, while we are away from your computer, take a minute, check out the books I've got for sale on Amazon. You can go to http://bit.ly/GiaBooks, GiaBooks, and it will show you all of the books that I've got listed with Amazon. There's a number of camping books. There's emergency preparation book. There's a novel. Surely something that will appeal to you and help support another starving author, right? And in the meantime, we will be right back with you in just a few minutes. So don't go anywhere else. Yeah, starving.
Whoa! Did you hear? Listen to the Church of Mavis radio show, hosted by Jeffrey Pritchett.
7
p.m. Eastern.
Friday.
Nice. Follow your weird and journey into the high strange. Be sure to stop by
www.churchofmavisradio.com
for upcoming shows, paranormal news, and show archives. That's
www.churchofmavisradio.com.
If you are listening to the show and wish to join us in the chat room, visit paltalk.com. Go to the social issues, select Other, and enter the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
The paranormal.
Ghosts.
Spirits.
Demons.
Reincarnation.
Past lives.
The afterlife.
Divination.
Exorcisms.
Witchcraft.
The unseen.
He's psychic medium Chris George.
And he's Victor the Voice Furman.
We are Second Sight Radio. Join us live
every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time
on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Truth is reality. The connection is you. Check out Catherine Buckley on Truth Connections Radio, Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on 107.7 FM, the Paranormal Radio Network.
Cemetery with your hosts Chip and Nicole every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, mindcemetery.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we host News on the Flip Side. Come join us every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Central for our three-hour program. We have opinions on everything, and we're not afraid to share them. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can find it here with News on the Flip Side. Remember, don't be politically correct. Just be correct. Join us.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Yes, I am here. I didn't hear bumper music for some reason tonight. So I got caught paying attention to something else. Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades, people. I'm
on everything.
I'm talking tonight with Gregory.
And we're not afraid to share them.
And we're going to try and bring Dr. Desmond Green in with us here in a bit, as well, as soon as we can jump on Joe's head long enough to get him to pay attention, right?
So, with that said,
we're enjoying spring. It looks like the weather is going to warm up after this last little freeze for us here in the south. Although I see, I was looking at Facebook a little bit ago, and a number of people up north are reporting snow. Just like Greg was saying earlier, yeah, a snow. When I think about camping, which is something I've had on the brain here lately, we've got an upcoming camping trip that I'm going to be getting ready for. It's made me think about days when you go camping and you would get either rain or snow in cold weather. Now, I have to admit, if I have to choose between camping in cold, icy rain or camping in snow, give me the snow. Snow is somehow surreal when you're camping. It's like the woods get really quiet and you can hear everything. In addition, there's not the same kind of cold dampness that gets in your bones, you know. So when when you're camping and it snows on you, your tent is being insulated by the snow. And, you know, it also muffles sounds, so you wake up and it's like really quiet. Now, anybody who's done a lot of camping knows, people talk about the quiet of the great outdoors. Oh, bull hockey. Here in the south, you go camping and the sun goes down and the noise begins. They're partying in the woods tonight. You hear crickets and frogs and night birds and all this noise. And it can almost become overwhelming. It's so loud sometimes. And we do some camping, you know, in good weather. We may not opt for the tent. I discovered a long time ago that assuming mosquitoes aren't an issue, which sometimes in the south they are, but to just sleep under a tarp, you get much better breezes and yet you don't get to do. And so you get all the noise. There's no thin piece of nylon to muffle some of the noise around you. And you do hear a lot of noise. The woods are amazingly noisy. And you can tell when there's a predator in the area or somebody creeping around being sneaky in the woods because things go quiet. And that's when you get, you know, the hair on the back of your neck will raise up. But talking about hair-raising experiences, Greg, have you ever heard a mountain lion scream?
Well, I have the unfortunate misfortune to work in a small mountain lion. I guess you'd call it Black Panther. Probably not anything close to the end of the species that's out west. Because I'm pretty sure if it was one of those mountain lions that lurk around, I've seen Navajo cops, it would probably have been deciding that I was going to be dinner.
Well, you know, they typically hunt elk. Elk is their favorite food, I gather, in the West. And they do the drop-down kind of hunting, typically. The area we camped in a lot, there was a mountain lion that lived there. We knew it was there. Sometimes you would watch it watching you if you were hiking in the area. And there was also a bear that had a den in the area. So we did have some wildlife we knew was there that we had to watch out for. The bear was known to have a bad temper. But this mountain lion would at night a few times when we were camping, it would scream in the canyons. And that scream echoing through the canyons and the hills, talk about hair raising. It's like, oh, even though you knew it was miles away, because sound carries so far with canyons and whatnot, it still would really raise the hair on the back of your neck.
Well, yeah, it was a little hair-raising for me walking. You know, I've also been fortunate enough to be walking with the wind going the opposite direction, so that when I came across a mountain bear, The wind didn't alert the bear to my presence before. Luckily, I was alerted to the bear's presence and it will do an about face and head downhill away from it. And in both cases, I have to say this much, that I was prepared for what I was doing. I was sufficiently armed in the event that I was at that much of a close quarter with either one of the animals. I stood a pretty good chance of being able to at least injure the animal or possibly kill it before having anything happen to myself. A lot of people like to go camping and hiking, and they really don't see, you know, any practical sense in taking along a shotgun or a rifle, let alone a pistol, for their protection. But if you're going to be out there by yourself, one of the practical applications for a handgun or a rifle is that you can at least use it to signal off to other people that you're in need of help as well. They might not be able to reach them by a cell phone. They will definitely, in most cases, be able to sort of pinpoint where you're at if you're able.
Well, I have to argue with you on that.
Same area.
I used to be guilty of a lot of solo hiking and camping, which caused my friends and family a great deal of worry, which is why I actually have Red Dog. But I was so far out that there would have been no way anybody heard a gunshot unless they were already looking for me. And how would I know that they were looking for me? Yeah, Red was actually gotten originally as a bear dog. For people who are not familiar with what function a bear dog has, it's not to hunt bear, it's not to kill bear. Their job is simply to create a diversion and allow the person to get away. They're not supposed to actually engage the bear. They're supposed to just bark, make noise, and get its attention. Anyhow, that was the purpose for which I got Red Dog. Then the standing joke was I would probably die saving her from a bear. yeah, Red Dog has never had a bear encounter. She has seen some horses, which she regards as dangerous, stinky dogs. What else is she? Oh, the skunk encounter. Yeah, we had our first skunk encounter when she was still a puppy. She was going on a year old. We were on a camping trip. And I had spilled dog food. Now, I know that when I'm camping in remote areas, spilling dog food, you pick up every single tidbit of kibble because you do not want to attract wild animals into your campsite. Well, I was lazy. I didn't pick it all up. There was some left. And I had also set my trash outside of the tent rather than going in and putting it in the trash can. Anyhow, I wake up to the sound of something crunching outside the tent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what is that? And she was growling very, very softly. Now, the tent I was using at that time, I had a cot inside of it, so I didn't have to sleep on the ground. She actually slept on the foot of the cot because that was the only space left over for the dog. And she was growling very softly. There was something crunching outside the tent, and I had no idea what it was. We were in a campground in an agricultural area. Okay, we were surrounded by fields and whatnot. There wasn't any signs of wild anything nearby. So I had, like I said, I'd gotten lazy. So I very slowly unzipped the window, and I looked out to the rear end of a skunk. Now, this is a brand new tent, and looking at the rear end of a skunk, and I've got a dog, a puppy, that's pretty much untrained yet, and all it's going to take is her starting to growl louder or bark. So I very carefully ease the zipper closed again, because after all, that nylon's all that's protecting me from that stink. And I put my hand over her nose, and I very softly breathed to her to be quiet. And believe it or not, she really, really was. She didn't make a sound. And even the rumbling in her chest kind of eased up. And we laid there and we listened. And finally the skunk had finished rummaging through the trash and had eaten all the dog food and went on its merry way. And the next morning I got to clean up the spilled and chewed trash. And after that, I never made that mistake again. Yeah, so even if you feel like you're in a safe environment, don't get lazy in your campsite. You know, don't, if your dog spills dog food, yes, you really do got to pick up every single piece of kibble. Don't get lazy about not taking your trash to the secured trash can before you go to bed, because something will be there. We've even had skunks, well, it was coons, I think it was, that had hot chocolate and graham crackers one night, wasn't it, Greg?
Yeah, you know, even when you're camping in the campground areas that are in semi-civilized areas, the thing about the raccoons and other wildlife is they're territorial. They understand where the food source is, so they're going to be prowling around, and you're not the first camper that's shown up there. And if you happen to have brought in a Domino's pizza box or something like that, you know, from the realm of civilization, I mean, that's an instant attraction.
And they're quick, even in daytime when you're in the campsite doing stuff. I have turned around and I've had squirrels munching on cheese and so forth, and crackers and so forth. I've had them chew into my tent. You never, ever, ever allow food inside your tent, because it is like issuing an invitation forever to every small animal in the vicinity.
And you can even stain the fabric out of things. And you would think that with the modern tent fabrics and everything, that you can be able to clean something out. Believe me, you're not going to get the smell of grease and stuff out of it sufficiently enough for it to not attract that animal, even if it's a year or so in the future. It's going to effectively scent that fabric. I mean, that may sound sort of cool, but one of the reasons they have the tables and everything outside of where you would normally put your primitive tent in the camping areas, even the ones that have RV parking, is so that you can eat away from that, because the reason the raccoon or the bear or the skunk or anything is going to try to chew its way into the tent is not because it sees you as something tasty, but because there was, you know, spilled beer and pizza that was all over the outside and inside and the floor of the tent and on the wall, and it was never properly cleaned up, because, you know, the animal senses are, you know, 100 times better than ours in some cases, and that pizza is going to smell like it's there from last year, just as if it happened yesterday.
Yeah, and, you know, when you're going camping, too, most of the time you can cook pretty much the same food as you cook at home, okay, if you have any skill in any culinary activities at all, you can manage it. There is one food, however, that I can definitely say I cannot see any way to prepare it in a campsite. And he who shall not be named, one time on a group camping trip, brought a box of frozen corn dogs. Now, this is cold weather camping. They're not going to thaw anytime soon. And you cannot roast frozen corn dogs on a campfire. You cannot cook them in a skillet. I'm sure you could eventually put them in a Dutch oven and with coals get them hot all the way through. However, you know, as far as I was concerned, the effort required to dine on these delightful tidbits was not in accordance with the delight we were going to get out of them. But I do regard it as humorous. You cannot cook corn dogs over a campfire. It won't work. Yeah. So that remains forever in my things thou shalt not do list, and that's bring corn dogs camping. Now, it's a different case if you're camping in an RV or travel trailer. You have
it actually
your same
can
kind of
be done. We'll not argue that it's a very, very bad idea to bring them in completely frozen, but it can be done. There are devices known as reflector oven, and there are also ways of making a box out of aluminum foil or sheet metal boxes. We happen to actually own a oven that you could use while you're camping, folks, that can either sit on top of the old campground grill, or you can cook with it over a fire in a hole in the ground that will bake biscuits. So it's not out of the realm of possibility yet. It's just very, very technically difficult.
Well, like I said, you know, it could be done, but the amount of effort required in comparison to having corn dog was just not, you know, really agreeing with the situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And never, ever allow your friends to stash a jar of cheese dip under your seat to be forgotten for months. That's another horrific experience.
Experience that makes you feel like your life has become that Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon movie, Grumpy Old Man with the Dead Fish.
Yeah, I was pretty sure we had something dead in there. Folks, I'm not kidding. It was so bad. You had the windows all down, your head hanging out, and you're still fighting the urge to Ralph. Okay, this stinks. It smells like something dead. Greg had gone through the van over and over again. We now know where he forgot to look the first time, and that was under the passenger seat. And eventually, it was found by Greg. Thank goodness it had not exploded. It was in a glass jar. It did not explode. But, oh, the smell was unforgettable.
The only thing that has been in that particular van that was anything worse was when there was a forgotten can of cat food, which was used as chum during one of our river fishing expeditions on Pensacola River. It had been left at the bottom of a plastic container that was used for some netting and some extra little sparkly shinies for fish to bite at, and it had long since passed its expiration into the other realm, and yet we were riding around, and I can remember our son-in-law's esteemed displeasure having the windows all rolled down, sitting in the back jump seat of the van and wondering what died.
For the occasion of our arrival of our granddaughter. The things that we mark negative experiences with, you know, the stinky van with a can of forgotten cat food, which it had been partially opened, and we were actually using it as crab bait so that the crabs would get in the little trap thing. It worked well for crab bait. It might have worked real well after it started stinking, but we wanted to get rid of it at that point. But that didn't seem to take too long to clear out the smell, but it hadn't been in there as long either. So, yeah. Fish bait can become quite stinky quite quickly. You know, we often, when we were fishing on the coast, would use squid or what was that other stuff? Some sort of chopped up fish. Or shrimp. And all of those things, when they sit in the hot sun, start to develop aroma that, you know, isn't going away anytime quickly.
Yeah, you always want to dispose of the shad and minnows and the other things. You don't want to try to refreeze or keep any of that stuff around. And, I mean, some people might look at it and say, well, you know, it's just being a little frugal, you know, throw the stuff back and
We did refreeze it sometimes, but if we'd been out in the boat, say, all day, and we had leftovers, that was usually like semi-cooked from the sun, and that wasn't going to be much good refrozen. Sometimes the shrimp even looked as though it had been cooked. It would turn that pink instead of the translucent color. So the sun can do, you know, I could see where it could be used for cooking. I felt cooked when we come in after being in the boat all day. You know, kind of lobster
and,
red.
That's the other thing, folks. You also, you know, you want to make sure you keep stuff like sunscreen around, not just for the days when you know that you're going to go to the park. It's one of the things we actually kind of had a stash in what we affectionately call the camping van. There's sunscreen, bug spray, and that's very important. GM may or may not admit that publicly on any occasion. Being without the repel means that you're in deep doo-doo. And so the sunblock and stuff, because you never know when also you're going to have some kind of vehicle trouble, and you're going to be stuck walking for quite a ways.
A hat is a really good idea, too. Having a hat to help block the sun off your head, that makes a big difference. A lot of people don't realize it. A wide-brim hat, I know it's not the latest in fashion, but it really, even a ball cap helps a lot at keeping the sun off your head. You know, speaking from personal experience, I have sunburned the part of my hair. It's very painful, especially if it blisters. It's also gruesome when it starts to peel. We're talking mega dandruff flakes here, folks, you know. Imagine the peeling that you get, like, on your shoulders after a sunburn. If it's on your scalp, you know, it really is not what you want to do. So wear a hat.
Yeah, never can be too careful.
Yeah, a hat is a great thing. You know, all the winter storms and everything, a lot of people don't keep a emergency kit in their vehicle, and they really should. And it should include things like your insect repellent, your sunscreen, hats, some water,
you have to have candles.
Those energy bar things, you know, emergency food bars, whatever they're called. And as well as your flares and your jack and your spare tire and things like that. You should have things for personal comfort. And if you live in a winter climate, you know, adding a candle might not be a bad idea. That was always a candle and a blanket was always included in ours when I was a kid. They used to keep chocolate bars, too.
Today, you don't even have to really worry too much about having the blanket fibers in it where a rodent might get into your storage compartment on your vehicle and decide that it makes a good nest because you have the polyacrylic and the reflective NASA type of space blankets that are also super lightweight. And beyond being an emergency kit in your car, they can be in an emergency kit that you keep in a duffel bag or a backpack that you can carry with you in the event that you have to leave your vehicle. You get stuck with a catastrophic breakdown and, you decide that you can't wait any longer for the pickup tow truck that's going to pick up your vehicle. Well, you've got to hike off the interstate exit to the nearest gas station or McDonald's because you might have a young one or two with you that can't just go pee in the woods. those things happen, and that's how you usually end up. Well, it's a mile and a half to 4 miles, and, you know, having.
But at the same time, in snowy conditions, they do not recommend ever leaving your vehicle. And that's because it is easy to get lost. It's easy to suffer from hypothermia and become disoriented. And as a result of that, actually freezing to death, and et cetera, et cetera. They do not recommend you leaving your vehicle. One of my favorite things to carry in an emergency kit is these micro fleece straws. They fold up real compact. You can put them in a quart Ziploc bag, and yet they are amazingly soft and warm. I love those things. You know, they are so handy. I've used them for shawls when I needed a jacket and didn't have one. I've used them as a liner when in the sleeping bag when it got a little colder than what we were expecting. And that kind of thing happens, you know, and having one of those throws along can really be nice. In addition, you know, if you're traveling and you just simply get cold and you want a light throw in the car, well, you can pull it out of the trunk or wherever you keep it, and you've got this throw, you know, add a travel pillow, and, hey, you're in the lap of luxury while your partner does the driving. And I know all about that lap of luxury, don't I, Greg?
Side seat driving.
Yeah, usually he does the driving and I get him sleeping.
Another thing that Jan really hasn't touched on, I guess we can in the last 20 minutes or so of the show, is her passion for all things bicycle and tricycle. And I know one of the amusing things this past week, unless you were Gia and you were searching on the site, to type into the old Walmart search engine, looking for adult bicycles and kind of 10-inch tricycles. Wasn't very fun, but bicycling season in the south is upon us, and bicycling season both. Everybody in the north and northeast is going to be upon us, unless you've got a couple of skis strapped to your bicycle in certain places. You're still not getting anywhere. Gia, talking about the thermal blankets and the little emergency kits and stuff like that, you also have to take those down a notch and micro-size them and put them into a kit that you can carry on a little Velcro on pouch on your bicycle if your bicyclists are doing it on a recreational trail like we have done before, or you are bicycling for long distances. It is going to one of these days come in very key, because you're going to find yourself in a rock and a hard place or with a bent bicycle wheel rim, and you're going to need some of that emergency stuff that's in that goodie bag, aren't you?
Yeah, you know, and storms, spring storms, as well as, you know, when we get into summer, it'll be summer storms, can blow up really, really quickly when you're out for the day on your bicycle. In addition, people, as you're driving around, as spring comes upon us and people are getting out and about, I know I've seen a lot of bicycles out here in the South. So often, motorists are not very considerate of bikes. Mississippi, the state we live in, happens to have a far higher than national average number of especially hit-and-run bicycle fatalities. You know, watch out for these not only bicyclists but motorcyclists as well, because both of them are going to be out. Watch for them. You know, give them a little bit of room. Most bicyclists are going to be very courteous. They are going to be on the shoulder of the road if possible, or as close to it as possible. A lot of Mississippi's roads do not have a paved shoulder. They have no choice but to ride in the lane. You know, give them a couple of feet. You know, slow down a little bit as you go around them. And you certainly don't need to scream things at them. You know, I know, you know, for a while we used a bicycle exclusively, you know, and we had some encounters with some very nasty motorists who don't feel that bicyclists even have a right to be on the road. It is actually illegal in most states for bicyclists to ride on sidewalks. Yes, they do have a legal right to the road, and you have the legal responsibility to pay attention and not hit them. Now, granted, accidents happen. You know, something can go wrong, and a bicyclist can end up in your lane all of a sudden, you know, through no direct action of their own, no fault of yours. But, you know, do try to be a little bit considerate of them. Don't throw things at them. Don't try to whack them with your window, the mirror. Don't try to door them. You know, all sorts of things I've either heard about or seen. And, you know, be nice to them. Bicycles are really good for communities. Communities that have a high percentage of cyclists tend to be more affluent than communities that do not. Maybe it's because more affluence means more education, and more education means you're more inclined to cycle. That's what some people claim. I don't know if it's true or not. But, you know, when you look at communities that have bike lanes and all the other things that make cycling safer and easier, you do see more affluence. So, you know, maybe that also correlates with why Mississippi isn't doing so well with cyclists. We are seeing more bike lanes in Mississippi, and I'm thrilled with it. But am I a cyclist that is going to be doing any cross-country journeys? No, not anytime soon. But, you know, at the same time, I do sometimes ride a bicycle to go to the store or run some other errand, and I like to do it safely. So do keep an eye out for them.
Yeah, and support, especially
support the stuff for cycle lanes and all those kind of lovely features in your own community, too, because they do make nice communities. Go ahead, Greg.
And spring also, not just cyclists on the main road, but spring also means children with the tricycles that you really weren't looking for, and with the small bites in the neighborhood. And again, like I said, a lot of the accidents happen within a mile or two of your home, and you really want to be careful about the kids in the neighborhood, because you know the kids tend to come in the neighborhoods where there is a sidewalk, flying down the sidewalk at a hell-bent pace, and in the areas where the children end up riding along the side of the road, they're probably going to be paying a little bit more attention to catching up with their brother, cousin, sister, or one of the other neighborhood children, and they're not going to be looking for you when you're backing or pulling out of your driveway.
And kids tend to come out of nowhere chasing a ball, a puppy, a cat, a leaf, or whatever it is that they're chasing. So, yeah, you slow down in your residential areas. Watch for kids. If they're playing in the yard, they can soon be in the roadway ahead of you, and nobody wants to be responsible for injuring a child. So, yeah, pay attention. It's that time of year. They're going to be running amok in our neighborhood soon. Here in the South, you know, pretty much year-round kids are out and about. Pets make their escapes, too. We had our lovely young Toffee make her escape a few days ago. She had a grand old time playing with the neighborhood kids before she joined our neighbor's pit bull in dining on chicken and didn't want to come home when she was told to, like an ill-behaved child, and Greg had to retrieve her. And carry her home, literally carry her home, because she wanted to have more chicken.
Yeah, and the kids did, they did enjoy it. But again, if you're a motorist coming through the area, you're also, you then have my dog playing and cavorting around with the neighborhood kids, then the kid is just about as likely to follow that puppy out into the street as the puppy was to gallop across to get to play with it in the first place. So, You just gotta keep your eyes peeled for that kind of stuff. It's not just trash cans; it'll be out in the street.
Yep. And you know, so it's yeah. While you're looking at the beautiful flowers, because we're about to enter the most beautiful season in Mississippi, when everything begins waking up and begins to bloom. We've seen the yom pine is in full bloom right now all through the South. Red clover is starting to bloom alongside the roads. I'm actually going to experiment and make a batch of red clover jelly. Yeah, I have no idea what it's going to taste like, but I thought it was an interesting idea. I'm not going to make a big batch, but I am going to make a batch of it to have a few jars to sample and see what we think of it. You know, things are blooming. The azaleas will be blooming. Our rhododendron is blooming now. You know, camellias will be blooming, gardenias, all sorts of things. And the whole countryside will explode. Then the wisteria comes in. And if you've never smelled the scent of wisteria in bloom, you are missing out on something. We have some growing in our yard up an old live oak. And, you know, for a couple weeks this spring, it'll literally carpet the lawn with purple petals. And the sweet scent, oh, it is absolutely divine. There's something, you know, incredibly, I guess, romantic. It's practically Victorian in its sense of lush romanticism. And these falling petals, the sweet aroma, the blooms hanging down from the vines as they wrap around this big old tree. It really is kind of amazing. I mean, you really can't help but smile when you experience something like that. And we'll see that all the baby animals, calves and colts and baby donkeys and, you know, all that kind of stuff, too.
Unfortunately, I had the misfortune to run into any neighborhood baby goats, but where my aunt and uncle in West Virginia, they have a goat family on the farm next to them, and almost ran the goats over more than once. And we're inside the city limits, too. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're out of the realm of possibility of having ye olde escaped wildlife running amok. And it does happen. We've got some video footage of, you know, the aardvarks under the trees, and, you know.
It's not an aardvark. It's an armadillo.
Okay, yeah.
I don't think aardvarks are native to America. See, now I'm going to have to search and find out where aardvarks actually live. But yeah, the nine-banded armadillo is the species that lives in the southern U.S. And that's quite interesting to watch as they root around looking for worms and grubs and whatever else it is that they eat. What I found curious is they're the only carrier of leprosy besides humans. And that was kind of creepy, you know, especially since when we lived in Louisiana, we weren't far from the old leper sanatorium or leper colony, which, you know, I guess I had never thought about. That existed until the mid-20th century and continued quite some time after that with the people that had been residents there for their entire lives. And I didn't realize that leper colonies had existed that late. But, you know, I don't know whether armadillos can communicate the disease to humans or not. I don't know anything about communication of leprosy. At the same time, the thought of eating an armadillo that might carry leprosy kind of, for people that don't know me real well, I will try anything once, okay? We have the Great Coon Experiment, where I made tamales out of the coon. They weren't very popular, especially after I asked Greg, because the coons that I had been given had been skinned and cleaned, but they had their feet attached, and I needed the feet removed.
Just, you know, in defense of their condition, they were robbing the corn bins where the corn was being put up for feed, because in deer season, what you do is you put a little box on the side of the tree, and you put out some feed corn, and the deer becomes accustomed to coming there, and that helps them keep a little bit of weight on you. You're not going to sit there waiting by the tree to shoot the deer as it comes through the area, but it gives the deer the reason to traffic your property, because, you know, we need goodies. And Mr. Raccoon and his buddy decided to help themselves to deer corn bins, so that's why they ended up in their state.
Yeah. Well, they'd shot the coons, they'd cleaned them, and then I was going to cook them. Well, I wanted the feet removed before I roasted them, which was the first step in preparation for making tamales. Anyhow, I had asked Greg and our son-in-law to cut the feet off and put them in the oven for me while my daughter and I went and did something else. And we had to run in town to get, I think it was to get the other things we needed for making tamales. Anyhow, they asked how to do it. I said, just get the loppers or pruning shears or something like that and cut them off. Didn't seem like a big deal to me. Now, I come from a country family where doing doing your own butchering was not unusual. I can remember waking up, you know, like 4 o'clock in the morning and seeing my uncle and cousins carrying, you know, a cow carcass through the living room to hang it in the bedroom. You know, so this isn't something, you know, that I regarded as abnormal or gross or weird. You know, when we would roast a goat, my uncles would kill the goat and butcher it and cut it up, and, you know, they'd bring it to us to cook. It was all prepared. You know, so...
So this is an experiment in exposing someone who has never been exposed to the realities of, let's just take the pruning shears and the feet are gone. And no, we didn't do it to roast the feet. We did it to be able to roast the
I wanted the feet cut off because that part wasn't going to be used anyhow. And they had the nails and they weren't as clean as I would like. So I just wanted the feet cut off. And so anyhow, I didn't realize that my son-in-law, you know, Greg comes from a similar background. So this was kind of like, just like killing a chicken. You know, if you eat meat, you need to know how it becomes meat instead of a living, breathing animal, period. And that was just the ideology that was always behind it. You know, if you didn't want to have any part with its preparation, you better be a vegetarian. And the running joke is vegetarian is another word for bad hunter. We went on our merry way, and I didn't think anything more about it. You know, just take the loppers and cut it off, cut them off, 4 feet on each one. I was doing two coons. And apparently this didn't go well with our son-in-law, who was very much a city boy in a sense. Came from a small town, but he had never participated in anything that pertained to the process of changing meat from animal to meat. And so he was horrified. He couldn't eat any of it. He even got kind of green if you showed him any part of it. Now, Greg thinks it's because the feet of a raccoon resemble human hands. I don't know what it was. I think it was simply the fact that the process was shocking to him. And there again, because he had not been raised with the same sort of ideology and activities. I mean, I can remember my first biology lessons were sitting at the table as my mother was gutting chickens and geese. So, yeah.
Well, you know, and as spring finally comes in different parts of the world, remember to get your children, your grandchildren, your, you know, not great grandchildren, and carry them around to different places. Go see a farm. Go see a place where they can have a petting zoo. You don't necessarily have to go to the metropolitan zoo in the city where you live at. You can use the internet now and find these places. They're there, and the children can go interact with the animals. I mean, you're not going to necessarily have milking the cow, but they will be able to safely interact with the animals without the ability to communicate any sort of disease, and they get to learn a little bit about it, and they don't necessarily have to be told how each type of animal is prepared for consumption, but if they can be told that, in fact, the chickens are where the eggs do come from, and the cow is where the milk does come from, and so on and so forth, and it's a wondrous experience for the children. It's educational as well, and also it can serve to get them away from, you know, the skating rinks and the other built-in, you know, electronified, you know, static TV on every wall and, you know, pizza to be shoveled in type of experience where they're expecting that, you know. They may enjoy it. They may ask to have you find a place where they can be sent up to a farm for a camp, you know, as they get older. You may find a farm that has, you know, co-opted milk and butter and cheese and other organic food products as well, depending on what part of the country you live in and what kind of difficulties your local farmers have had. And you can make the whole thing into an interesting experience, because in a lot of cases you then end up taking some fresh farm product back for your own dinner table, and you're having a better experience with that than you would be if you stopped off at a Bob Evans restaurant or a Cracker Barrel, and you think that's not very far removed from homemade.
I'll tell you what, some of the best times I can remember, now my parents were not farmers. We didn't raise our own livestock when I was a kid. So when I would stay with a farm family, I got to experience things like bottle feeding calves, which I did as a teenager while I was staying with an aunt and uncle one summer. So you bottle feed the calves, and you let them suck on your finger, and you were amazed by the power that they could suck on your finger with. I mean, it practically felt like it was sucking your finger off. And, you know, just it was fascinating to a kid, even one who did it every year. You know, when I was growing up, we did it every year. Learning how to milk cows, because, granted, milk machines have changed a lot in the last 40 years, 50 years. But, you know, we had to strip the cow's udder before the milking machine was attached. So even though we were little kids, we were taught how to do that because it really speeded up the process for the adults hooking up the milking machines. And you know, we would spray it at the cats who would stand up even on their hind legs to catch the stream of milk. We would have a ball doing this. You know, it may have been work, but for us, it was playtime, too. And learning how to put out the
food
for the cattle.
I'm sure the cats enjoyed it as well.
Well, yeah, the barn cats, they had an absolute ball. I mean, obviously, they sat up to get the stream of milk. You know, and all the things that we did on the farm, collecting eggs. And I can remember, you know, we lived on a farm, but we just used the house part. And when cousins would come, I remember one city cousin, he spent an entire day in the chicken house waiting to see a chicken lay an egg, which we thought was about the dumbest thing we'd ever heard of. Because
you know,
everybody knows a chicken's egg comes out its butt. Okay, that's just, there was nothing fascinating about it. Sometimes chicken eggs have bird poop on them too, you know. So, you know, this was normal to us. That was just farms. We knew what baby pigs were like, and we knew that a mama pig could kill you and eat you before anybody could save you. So, yeah, you know, we respected, because every year somebody was killed by a sow when I was growing up. And so you did. You were taught from the time you were very little, if a sow's got pigs, you stay the heck away. One year, a Sunday morning, it was, as a matter of fact, my brother and sister and I were playing on the swing set, which tells you I wasn't all that old, and I heard a noise. We had a big bed of irises alongside the garage, and I heard a noise in those irises, which were like 8 feet from the swing set, and I looked back there, and there's a sow who's just had a litter of piglets. I can remember having the screaming heebie-jeebies, shooing my brother and sister, who were younger than me, into the house and, you know, half hysterical getting my mother, because those pigs were going to get us. I was sure of it. They were going to eat us all. Who could call the farmer, because at that point we lived in town, obviously right on the edge of town, but and it was a very small town, population 200, I think, after we moved there. It's just still a teensy, teensy town. But, you know, my mom actually looked the guy up that owned the farm next to us and called him and said, "You got a sow and piglets over here." And they came and got the sow and the piglets. She turned out not to be mean, but some of them are.
I guess it just goes animal by animal. I've seen, you know, docile milk cow. And I've also seen a milk cow that you really wanted to stay away from, even when you were the other milk cows, and not necessarily far enough away from the electric fence that the cow is run up to, because the electric fence might not make that much of a difference for that animal. They just have in very distinct temperament. People always think that sheep always, you know, sort of behave the same. That's the expression, you know, the people are acting like sheep. And to be honest, they also have their own individual personalities, and you're going to come across one that's not going to be very nice every now and then. So that was the reason for saying that the children's petting farms and zoos and whatnot can be a little bit more structured and supervised, and you don't have as many worries as you do on a family farm environment where the children might take off with other children.
Things like wander. We would always wander into the pasture where the bull was. And I can remember, because the one farm family that we stayed with, the bull would ignore you until you got near the horses. Well, of course, horses and little girls, it was an inevitable thing. We were going to go get the horses. And, you know, so all I was worth. And the bull's so close at the end that I could actually feel him breathing, and then leaping into this, there was a feed wagon in the middle of the pasture, which was all the further we got, leaping in there just before the bull hit it.
Well, folks, you know, if you want to read some more recollections of stuff from Gia, go to http://bit.ly/GIABOOKS. That's bit.ly/geobook. And I'm sure amongst everything you'll find the Freak Files and some of her other recollections to be as amusing. Hopefully she'll put some of the farm anecdotes and things together for a family type book, and we're about out of time with this episode of the Dawn of Shades, our idea.
Yes, we are. So, folks, we are out of time. I hope that tonight's program has brought you a little entertainment as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Tune in again next week as we bring you an entirely new topic and new voice to tell us all about it. So with that, I bid you all farewell. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.